Welcome to a Pulp Event Podcast, brought to you by the PulpNet, your link to the online world of the pulp magazines, for over 20 years, online at thepulp.net. In this Pulp Event Podcast, the game is afoot, as Professor Garen Roberts and George Vanderberg discuss Sherlock Holmes and the pulps. The talk was recorded on August 16, 2019. At Pulp Fest 2019 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Garen Roberts begins.
We got a real treat tonight, and as so many things are at Pulp Fest. Give me a minute and a half tops to tell you about my good buddy here, my brother George Vandenberg. George has had quite a life and he's got a lot to go. He's done many, many wonderful things, and you may or may not know some of these things about him. Dr. Vandenberg spent a tremendous career as a medical man and as a surgeon. In addition, he served the world on the correct side of the good versus evil conflicts during the wars. He was a medic. I got that right, George? And you sit down and talk to him, my good buddy Bob Craig back there and I got to a couple years ago, and you realize that there's a lot to George. Really good stuff. I met George first in Toronto. It would have been a shady deal, except it was in a fairly decent hotel. George had come out with his 3-volume set of the Seabury Quinn volumes. And my buddy and long-term associate, co-editor, author for years, Gary Hoppenstein, was there. And we met George down in the lobby. And we made this deal, and we got three of the most beautiful books in this set. Now they're reprinted. You can get them online. I believe there's 4 of them?
5.
5 now, yeah. The definitive, the complete. The late Bob Weinberg was part of the project. George is pretty cool. Now shut up. Okay, that's enough for me. He's cool. The last thing I want to say before I ask George questions and try to stay out of it and look out, because he's got the information, is that like the last panel, I hope we have a little time at the end here because I'd love to hear what you have to ask George, and we'll go from there. The first appearance of Sherlock Holmes was in the famous Beaton's Christmas Annual, A Study in Scarlet. What can you tell us about that, George?
Well, that was the first Sherlock Holmes story, and Conan Doyle always lamented that he earned 25 pounds from Beaton's Christmas Annual, and that was the beginning and the end of any money he ever made on that book. 25 pounds, I guess, was a decent chunk of change in 1887. But America reprinted it any number of times in pirated editions, along with The Sign of Four, the second novel. And he didn't make any money on any of those things, but he moved on. And in my travels over the years, I always believed that Conan Doyle invented the short story for detective fiction in serial form, different stories, but all self-contained. But lo and behold, I found out later in my checkered life that a lady in Australia actually invented detective serial stories by attending police court in Australia. She had an interesting history. Her name was Mary Fortune Brett. And she actually left a relationship in Canada and immigrated to Australia and remarried again. So I guess there's a number of instances in bigamy in our literary past. Well, she was a classic example of one. From what I reconstructed, and Lucy Sussex originally put this collection together, she had a trouble with the drink over the years, like many accomplished literary people do. So in other words, Conan Doyle didn't invent the serial short story, lady by the Waif Wanderer, as she was nicknamed, or Fortune Brett did. Now, one thing I've looked for over the years and have never found yet, but I was told it exists, a cover color of Sherlock Holmes, cover in color of Sherlock Holmes on Munsey magazine. Now, maybe somebody in the room can help me because I still haven't found this thing, you know? So my favorite story was something called The Adventure of the Speckled Band. Everybody in the room read that story about the good doctor? Well, I had a term in the military. They put me through medical school, so I had to give them service afterwards. 6 months after I was graduated in practice, they said, you're going to Vietnam. So I did that, came back, finished my compulsory service, went into private practice. 20 years later, I stayed in the militia. So I had to pray 1 day a year in Canada in the militia. I don't know what you have to do down here, probably a wee bit more. And I got a call, one day I prayed it, I got called and said, you have to get in before December the 31st because you're gonna miss your year if you don't get in. So I went in, and then they phoned me the following February, my sergeant. He said, would you like to go to Africa? I said, sure, if I can get permission from my wife and my secretary. I've only had one wife and I only had one secretary, and they both lasted over 30 years. So I went there, and the night before I was invited by the sergeant to do that, I was reading one of Conan Doyle's books, My African Winter by title, and he was writing about going to Nairobi, Kenya, and that's where they were going to send me on this, coming out of retirement off the reserve list. So I went over, and that was when I was starting, that was in the early 90s. And so I went over there with a mission. I had the electronic form of the Sherlock stories, and I said, well, let's translate The Speckled Band, which was my favorite story, into Swahili. So that's what I set about doing, handing out U.S. Green at the graduate school there in Nairobi. And that, lo and behold, that turned out to be my very first publication. So I brought it to camp. And I had an editor who was a librarian at the Jomo Kenyatta Library in Nairobi. Our hotel was just around the corner. And he kind of reviewed it because I couldn't read or interpret Swahili, or Kiswahili. And the working title was incorrect, and he changed it because the gentleman that translated into Swahili used the term snake in the title, which kind of gives the whole business away. So we changed the title, and the title that we published is Majuba Ya Yutepi Wen Yi Mandoa. So that was my first publication.
How many appearances do you think Doyle made in Munsey magazine, Sherlock Holmes? Do you have any idea?
Well, there must be an index someplace, but I haven't found it.
Okay.
All right. But there's at least one I know about.
Excellent.
And I still haven't found that either.
Good. Good. You've taught me many things through the years, George, Dr. Vandenberg. Tell me about this Shirley Holmes. What was that all about?
Well, that's a good story. Because when I was working with Bob Weinberg over the Jules de Grandin, when I first met Bob, he was introduced to me by Lois Bentley. She had that bookshop in North Chicago. And so on one of my return trips from Sauk City, I dropped in to meet Bob, and I had 30 of the 93. And so he gave me a set of those Pinnacle paperbacks, and there was two or three in there that I still didn't have. So we got those there, and then he took me upstairs and showed me his line of Weird Tales. There was a complete run of Weird Tales on one bookshelf. And at that time, I had no appreciation of what I was looking at. I didn't know Weird Tales from home around. So he said, well, you can take two or three of my children at a time to carefully photocopy and scan them. And we did that over kind of like a 2.5 year period, because I was back and forth to Sauk City quite a bit. And then as we were coming up to completing that, and that was published on the 4th of September 2001, I know exactly because it was the week before 9/11, and I was actually in Sauk City on 9/11. But that's where we brought that out. I came back and saw Bob, and I asked Bob, I said, do you know of any good Sherlock Holmes publications from the Popes that we could publish? And he said, yeah, there's this 3 or 4 part serial that appeared in that magazine for Woolworths and Kresge's.
Yes, yes.
I can't remember the title, but it's... and so he said, I'd like you to do that, but the trouble is it's in my storage locker. So the next time I came down, he very gladly presented this serial to photocopy and scan. Like in many magazines, the illustrations are kind of merged into an oversized text, and they're difficult to reproduce properly in a 5.5, 8.5 paperback. So Shirley Holmes, this, what's his name? Coomer, serialized novel of a play by Basil Mitchell that appeared. And Shirley Holmes was the daughter of Sherlock Holmes. And this is another thing that kind of I don't really like, is changing the canonical stories to suit the author and the pastime. So, Conan Doyle was created Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. Watson had many wives, but Sherlock Holmes never married, to the best of my knowledge.
He did. Who was his famous girlfriend again? I can't think of her name.
Irene Adler.
That's right.
Yeah. She was an opera singer from New Jersey or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And but anyway, so that came out. And the one thing about it I kind of like is Shirley's Deerstalker. And they say write in and get a copy of the plans for this Deerstalker. Well, 70 years later, they're not answering their mail anymore. So anyways, Shirley Holmes' Deerstalker would be a good thing to emulate first.
But what year was that when Shirley Holmes first appeared?
I'd have to look it up.
Okay, but a while ago.
A while ago.
Yeah.
It's in there.
Yeah.
One of the first times I actually wrote an introduction to something. I couldn't write my way out of a wet paper bag, but I can do a blurb on a dust jacket now, okay. I think.
He does a little better than that, yeah. Yeah, with
this. Yeah. But anyways, I read that introduction that I did back then, and it wasn't bad. Yeah.
There have been hundreds and thousands of people who've gone beyond being fans and analysts of Doyle and Sherlock Holmes, and they've had a varying degree of success. People like William Baring Gould, and that's one I can think of right now, and there have been some others. But the really best ones, and I'm arrogant, I'm subjective, I'm opinionated. I would put you in that group, George. Okay, I like you and all that stuff, but I really think you are good. But who are your favorite scholars on Doyle and Sherlock Holmes?
Well, that's a good question. I had an early one-volume edition of Baring Gould, and you'll never see a signed Baring Gould annotated Sherlock Holmes because he died before it came off the press. Back in 67. He signed his other writings, Sherlock Holmes and Baker Street, or I can't remember the exact title, but he's got signs of those, but not of the annotated. That was his life work. I met his wife, I never met him, but I met his wife on a Bermuda cruise in 1991, 92, somewhere in there. And she was the typical Sherlockian widow, long-suffering. Most Sherlockians' wives suffer in silence if they suffer at all. But she was a nice lady. And that leads me to another story about Sherlock Holmes. She said, when I introduced myself and I was from Toronto, she says, do you know Tupper Bigelow? said, no. Well, he was an early Canadian that her husband hung out with and went to the racetrack. Every Sherlockian goes to a race once a year.
Uh-huh.
And
got to see Silver Blaze, right?
Yeah, that's the Silver Blaze.
Yeah.
And so she knew Tupper Bigelow. So as soon as I got back from this Bermuda cruise, I spoke to Cameron Hollier, who, if you don't know, was the librarian at the Toronto Central Library and then the Toronto Reference Library. And lo and behold, Tupper was in residence at the Veterans Wing up at Sunnybrook, which was a World War II military hospital. I did my third year medical school there, so I knew my way around. And I took Cameron up there one day, and we went in and met Tupper, and Tupper was suffering from not severe dementia, but moderate dementia. He couldn't manage on his own. And so I put together a collection of his scholarship, and that's it, this book here, and got Tupper to sign it before he passed. And back in the early days, I did this Sherlock binding, which is abhorred by most, if not all, traditional booksellers. But it was the only way I knew how to do a book back in those days. And so that was Tupper Bigelow's scholarship, and he was a big name in Canadian Sherlock Holmes. What was your question? I forgot what your question was.
Your favorite authorities on Doyle.
Well, I would say Tupper's scholarship in this book is second to none. And basically I collected that all together from searching on the word Bigelow in Ron DeWall's Sherlock Holmes bibliography. That appeared in three series. The World Bibliography, the International Bibliography in the mid-80s. The World was in the late 70s and was given away as a prize if you ordered three books from that wholesaler. I ordered it and actually sent it back because I wasn't interested in it at that time. Got a refund, but then Cameron Hollier introduced me to Ron DeWall, who was working on a third volume of that. And some numbers you forget, but this number I remember. There was 24,708 entries in this bibliography, from lapel pins to t-shirts to ice figures. John Benachok lighted ice figures of Sherlock Holmes in a freezer. So I don't know what happened to them when they all went up to Minnesota. But anyways, so Tupper and Baring Gould, I would say, and DeWall, of course. DeWall infuriated me. Ron suffered from manic depressive disorder, and I met at least a half a dozen Sherlockian ladies over the years that Ron had proposed to. But that's another story entirely. But anyways.
There's a contemporary guy, and I have a love-hate relationship with him. He's actually a dear friend, but he's beat me out twice for the Edgar Award. His name is Daniel Stashower. Have you ever read any of his stuff as recently?
I met him.
Yeah, nice man. He's very good, I gotta tell you. I deserve to lose to him those two times.
Well, I thought you'd mention Klinger, who's done the sort of modern version of the annotated. I've got stories on Klinger, but they're not for tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And I prefer the Baring Gould.
Mm-hmm. Excellent, excellent. Yeah. So then, the next question, and there's so many things I'd like to ask you, and we want to leave time for the good folks here too. We've mentioned Seabury Quinn's Jules de Grandin. We have kind of a reverse Sherlock Holmes situation where he takes, I'm stretching it here, but the Fu Manchu stories. Is Bill Maynard out there tonight? But anyway, where you've got the Sherlock Holmes type of team. There's the Solar Pond stories by Derleth. And for those of you who didn't quite catch that, George's reference to Sauk City. In the Midwest, Sauk City these days is known for Culver's, because it's the home of where the Culver's restaurant chain, I don't know how far east that comes out here. But no, that's not what Sauk City was great for. It was for Arkham House, of course. And George has been a longstanding advisor, editor, mentor of Arkham House, and another one of his many accomplishments. Okay, so we've got Seabury Quinn, Jules de Grandin, August Derleth, Solar Ponds, and there have been other ones. Do you have favorites of those kinds of imitations and stories and tributes?
Well, my bottom line on all this stuff are the 60 stories that represent the canon, the 56 short stories in 9 volumes in the 2 novels. Mm-hmm. Seven volumes in the 2 novels. Those are my favorite Parnon. A serious scholar once told me, in kind of an after-dinner cigar brandy kind of situation, that there are 2 kinds of Sherlockians. Well, I'm here to tell you there's a 3rd kind of Sherlockian. And the 2 kind of Sherlockians are fans and pseudo-scholars, because for pseudo-scholarship, it's not real scholarship because you're talking about a fictional character here, allegedly fictional. And
he's not with Elvis in Kalamazoo, is he? Never mind, it's okay.
All right. Well, there's a 3rd kind of fan now, and that's the kind of guys that go out and write pastiches, like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not a fan of pastiches, but I mean, it shows a love of the character. And back in the early 90s, late 90s, you know, a sort of post-prandial cigar dining kind of situations, mostly men, if not all men, we kind of discussed how the character who has outlived his creator is going to get into the next century. Well, lo and behold, Cumberbatch comes along, and he's got all his lady fans, which I got myself into deep trouble for because I used the nickname Cumberbunnies. I was accused of being a misogynist using these terms. But so there's 3 kinds. The pastiche writers, pseudo-scholarship, and fans. Just people that read the story for pleasure. I had to classify myself as a fan for many years, but after these few publications, I can make a claim at sort of trying to be a scholar.
Yeah. Oh, you very much are.
Yeah.
Very much.
Yeah.
You told us, and it was a question you predicted, that The Adventure of the Speckled Band is your favorite.
Yeah.
Of the 4 novels, which is your favorite of those?
The Hound of the Baskervilles.
Yes.
And I had that translated in Swahili. I have one on my desk, but I didn't bring it tonight. And a guy named Charles Meyer did the illustrations for it. It was very unique because I was in Africa for 6 weeks. And the first 2 weeks, I got the Speckled Band done, edited, typed in by the owners of the hotel secretary, and I kind of laid it out, formatted it a wee bit, and presented it to the Canadian ambassador when I left in an airplane to come home on a medevac in the middle of June 93. And that was a 31-hour medevac, by the way. That's interesting. But I came back with, a 9-segment manuscript of The Hound. And back in 93, if you remember, there was kind of the Hutu Tutsi massacre, and we had a lot of Kenyans in Toronto at York University at the time, so I sort of went around to try and find somebody that would take on the chore of transcribing this Kiswahili document in digital form. Well, I had to make a photocopy because I didn't want to give the original away. And I almost gave it to somebody that picked up stakes and went back to Kenya and was massacred. Or Uganda, that's where the massacre was.
Yes.
Yeah, Uganda, not Kenya. But I almost gave it to a guy to digitalize, but he went back and got massacred. So I gave it to somebody that got it, and he worked for a big company in Ottawa. And I think his wife did most of the work, but as in most cases, these guys. So it was good, it worked out, and I got it published, and Charles did the illustrations, and they were good. But that was my first favorite novel. That was the original question.
Is it like the 39 Basil Rathbone movie?
Well, of the 14 of them, my favorite is the first one, The Adventures.
Mm-hmm.
I think of The Hounds, that 40, of the hounds I've seen, I don't process to see, watch them all or listen to them all. The Russian guy's good, but my favorite hound, without a shadow of a doubt, is that one in 140.
How about, without checking off a list, I'd like to know your favorite Conan Doyle non-Sherlock Holmes work.
Well, I've read them all. I've transcribed them all in digital form. And that's a tough call for me because I had many favorites. But he was such a prolific guy. He also created a number of memorable characters, two of which are Professor Challenger and Brigadier Gerard. But he did short stories of Brigadier Gerard in the late 90s when Holmes was in hiatus. And he had brought him back because the editor of the Strand offered him so much money he could not bring him back.
In the Empty House.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, he brought him back in The Hound first.
Mm-hmm.
But he predated The Hound to before he took Sherlock over the Reichenbach. But then The Empty House, he brought him back for real. Made big money with that. And it was very, I suspect he was the highest paid English author at the time for the Strand magazine.
Wow.
Yeah.
Tell me about Jeremy Brett. Did you like his portrayal?
His early with the first Watson was brilliant.
Yes, yes.
But the latter ones, he showed his illness and he was very histrionic. And I suspect he had a very troubled personal life in those later stories.
He did, I understand.
And I haven't read the biography that his lady friend wrote on him.
Yeah, with his
but
wife's passing.
You could see it on the screen. He was a troubled man.
Yeah.
Which is another kind of interesting point about this character.
Mm-hmm.
Any number of characters that have portrayed him over the years, and there's virtually over 100 that have, become possessed with the character. Possessed. I mean, Gillette was obviously obsessed with his character. He built a castle and put a train around it in Connecticut somewhere. That's on my bucket list of places to go to, but I haven't gotten there yet. But so the guy that played, I met the guy that played him at the Shaw Festival back in 94, I think it was. And in my conversation with over at the luncheon table, I said, don't get possessed with this character. He'll eat you up. So I think he's moved on and done better things. But,
yeah. Okay, well, we know that the Sherlock Holmes stories appeared in a variety of different story papers, periodicals, and can you tell us a little bit about that?
I really can't.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I just don't know that material all that well. I'm sure people in the room know it much better than I do. But my default on that kind of question is to say I will consult Randy Cox.
Yeah, I just talked to Randy the other day. Maybe you'll remember Randy. He was our 2014 Amundsen Award winner. And I was really blessed because I got to give him the award and give him a big hug, because Randy's one of those great guys like George has done. Just the Blyler family and some of those people they're my heroes, and George is one of them. But yeah, Randy would know the different, the Lippincott's, the Strand magazine, the different, the Beaton's annual, and then all the different, and back in those days they had different formats, they call them dime novels in the U.S., pulp magazines. They had penny dreadfuls and shilling shockers and all kinds of variants in between, and Sherlock Holmes seemed to appear in a number of those things. My favorite Sherlock Holmes short story is The Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle, the Christmas story.
Absolutely, with the goose.
I love that story.
Now, that's another interesting thing about the goose and the crop.
Mm-hmm.
Gooses don't have crops.
Right.
All right. And that brings up another point in the Sherlock Holmes stories that too much paper has been wasted writing about. I think the quote is, so much has been written by so many for so few, which is a takeoff on Winston Churchill. Mm-hmm. But Tupper Bigelow summed it all up in the back of the book here that I published. The conundrums that I probably won't be able to find it here now. Well, I can't find it, but he listed in 6 or 7 points the conundrums that everybody writes about.
Sure.
Can't find it. And the one point was that, you know, maybe there is a goose that has a crop.
Mm-hmm.
What was Watson's middle name? Well, it's H, period. That's all it's listed in the stories. But Dorothy Sayers had, I think it was Dorothy Sayers, that named Watson's middle name Hamish for John in Irish. I think it was Dorothy Sayers. It might not have been.
It was. It was Dorothy Sayers.
Oh, wow, okay.
Because his wife, in one of the Doyle writes, his wife refers to John Watson as James.
That's right.
And because of that, Dorothy also
That's says exactly his right. That's
name
exactly.
Must be a Scottish Hamish, which is a familiar name for James.
Exactly.
So said, okay,
exactly.
Let's call him so, James instead of John. Yeah. Hamish must be his middle name for the age.
Yeah. So that's the kind of pseudo-scholarship that comes out of a work of fiction. Now, Doyle himself didn't give a tinker's damn about the chronology in the stories, and a lot of ink has been written, too much ink has been written about the chronology, and there's at least a dozen now accurate chronologists that think they have the story. But basically, the horns of the dilemma are there is no aspect to explain the chronology properly. You know, the setting of the moon and whatever. So that's another kind of thing that too much ink has been written on over the years.
Yeah, it's true. I had a student years ago in Ohio dispute the speckled band and can you hear the snake and does the snake make no- And after a point, it doesn't matter. It's just a story, you know.
That's right. And the snake, there was a plate of milk out for the snake.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know how many snakes that drink milk.
Mm-hmm.
But there was in the Sherlock Holmes story. I can't hear you.
Indian and European folklore about snakes that they drink
milk. Oh, is that right? Is it folklore?
Yeah, it's folklore. Yeah.
Ricky Tikki Tavi didn't.
Well, I guess it's like.
Is there a cobra that drank milk?
I guess it's kind of like, you know, putting milk out for Santa at Christmas. And that's the other thing I really like to do is if I'm sitting down for a cigar and brandy with somebody, and they're a firm believer that Sherlock Holmes is a real person, then I take the point of view of Conan Doyle, who killed him off because he came to dislike him intensely. And if I'm sitting at the same table in a different time, talking to a serious Conan Doyle story, I like to take the approach that I believe Sherlock Holmes is a real person. And the belief itself is equivalent to believing in Santa Claus, and I don't think there's anybody in this room that has a six or seven-year-old son, daughter, granddaughter, grandson, who doesn't believe in Sherlock Holmes, or in Santa Claus, which is the same deal. And if you see a recent convert to the cult
mm-hmm.
of Sherlock Holmes, you see that certain twinkle in their eyes. And I see it in this room over pulps, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You believe in pulp.
Yeah, but there's that twinkle there that is quite real. And I love seeing it in youthful people, even old people that are youthful.
I'll tell you what here, we want to have a little time for some questions here, so we're going to open that up in just a minute. And my old buddy George is probably going to kill me when I tell you this story. I want to tell you a personal side about George. You know, George, as we said, was a war veteran, a hero in my mind, and he was an accomplished surgeon. George used to always have trouble getting across the line when he came from Canada in the early days of the pulp cons and stuff, and he worried the living hell out of all of us. Here was this wonderful doctor with tubs full of books, and apparently the immigration or border people, no, they didn't like that. Well, one day George got to, it was a pulp con maybe in Dayton or Pulp Fest or Windy City, and he was kind of shaken. I don't know if you remember this, George, or not. And I thought, oh good, he just went through another search at the border, and we've treated him so well, you know, as us Americans, an ugly American, it really stands for who we are and how we treat our brothers. And I said, George, did you have trouble at the border? He said, no. He said, and this is George Vandenberg and his response. He said, I just came from a surgery on a lady, and I'm not revealing anything I shouldn't tell you. And he said, Garen, she's not gonna make it. And he was so upset that day, and I thought, this is why I love this man. George is one heck of a guy. And I gotta open this up for questions, because I know you got questions, and George has got some answers, and he doesn't even make them up. Yeah. Yeah, Sheila?
Yeah, when he talks about authoritative figures on Sherlock Holmes, I always thought that Vincent Sterrett was up there, didn't it? Comment?
Well, you know, Vincent Sterrett, that's another kind of obsession I've had,
right,
is collecting all of Vincent Sterrett. And I'm in search of one Jimmy Lavender story yet, and you know that, Sheila. And it's in one of the half dozen appearances of Amazing Detective Stories that I can't locate a copy of. But there's kind of like 52 Jimmy Lavender stories that Vincent created. And Jimmy Lavender was a baseball player in Chicago, I think, Chicago Cubs. But the reason I started Vincent Sterrett, and Cameron Hollier and I went back and found out where he was born, and it was published in his autobiography. It was done by the University of Oklahoma Press in 65, and I got rights to republish it, but I haven't done it yet, because Sterrett talked about having a 1,000-page manuscript of this Born in a Bookshop. That was the title of his autobiography. A nonsensical cover, wanted to do a different one, but I did visit the bookstore, which was the Upper Canada Bible Society in Yonge Street, where he first discovered Sherlock Holmes stories, influenced by his two aunts. And I visited the home where he lived. But the reason I wanted to do Vincent Sterrett was that, granted, he was born in Canada and moved to the States and spent the rest of his life in the States and died in impecunity carrying bags of books around. And I visited his grave like every two Sherlockians should. But the reason I wanted to publish him because he's Canadian. You know, so unfortunately, I'm United Empire loyalist as well. So once upon a time, my ancestors immigrated from Canada and got the UE after the name. I don't use it, but I'm entitled to use it because they got kicked out of the upper New York State after the Revolution. They were probably loyal to, a mad king. But anyways, that's why I wanted to do Vincent Sterrett, because he was born Canadian. And I had a nice argument with John Lellenberg over the years about that. John stopped talking to me. Well, that's another story.
Anybody else have questions for Dr. Vandenberg?
What kind of volume of non-Sherlock stories? I was out in California, and their library system wonderful out there. I got all of these collections of historical fiction, adventure fiction. I had no idea. I knew the Professor Challenge stuff, but I had no idea there was all this tons of stuff.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of collected editions, like the Kroger edition, which is kind of like 30 volumes, and the Sherlock Holmes stories are kind of like 9. So it's my understanding there's about 1 million words, and I don't know how many are Sherlockian words, but there's a substantial, the Sherlock Holmes story occupies up to about 1 million words, but the other are a couple of million anyway. I could give you the exact number because it's all in the computer. There's a few typos in there, but they're all in the computer, and I can search on anything in the computer, Doyle. But he had a large correspondence, and he's quoted in his correspondence, and you can't search that because it's not digitized. made the acquaintance of Richard Lanson Green over the years and John Michael Gibson, and they did their bibliography of A. Conan Doyle, and that won an Edgar. And John Michael Gibson is a real character as well. But that's a story for another day.
Thank you very much, George.
Thank you.
I love you, pal.
You've been listening to a Pulp Event podcast, brought to you by the Pulp.net, your link to the online world of the pulp magazines, for over 20 years. Please visit us online at thepulp.net. Thank you for listening, and keep reading the pulps. The Pulp Event podcast is copyright 2019.